Hello, and welcome to Astronomy Magazine's podcast. I'm Jeremy McGovern, assistant editor with the magazine, and this week I'm speaking on the phone with Caltech's Nick Scoville and Jason Rhodes. They are members of the Cosmic Evolution Survey Project, which created the first three-dimensional map of dark matter. This project, the largest ever undertaken with the Hubble Space Telescope, provides the first direct look at the large-scale distribution of dark matter in the universe. Jason, considering dark matter is invisible, how do you map it?
Well, this dark matter is dark because it doesn't interact via the electromagnetic force. So what that means is it doesn't absorb or give off light, like most of the baryonic matter that we see. So that's why we call it dark or invisible. But it does interact gravitationally. So the way we can map or detect this dark matter is we can look at the gravitational signature of the dark matter. We do that by looking at light from galaxies behind the dark matter, that is, background galaxies. That light, as it passes through or near these foreground dark matter clumps, will be deflected via gravity. So we look for those small deflections of background light by the foreground dark matter. And this light deflection is a telltale signature of the amount and distribution of that dark matter. That's how we can map it out.
Nick, is the effect slight on the scale at which you were measuring?
It's an extremely subtle effect on the scales which we're measuring in the Cosmos Survey, in the sense that we're measuring the distortion of space caused by very large extended concentrations of dark matter extending 5 to 20 megaparsecs. And so the amount of actual bending of space as a result of that fairly diffuse massive structure is very small, and the background galaxies might have a distortion of roughly 1% in their images.
That 1% distortion that Nick is talking about is much too small to be seen with the naked eye. And in fact, it's too small to be detected on a single galaxy in the background. So what we have to do is we have to look at many, many thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even millions of galaxies to look for this signal in a statistical sense. And that's how we get the foreground distribution of dark matter.
So the unique thing about the Cosmos Survey, which has finally enabled this kind of study, is several-fold. One is that we're covering a very large area of the sky, 2 square degrees, and that means that we can map the very largest structures which are seen. But the survey also very importantly started out with very high resolution imaging from the Hubble telescope, a total allocation of 590 orbits, which enables us to mosaic an image across that full 2 square degrees. Now with the HST imaging, you basically obtain the shapes of all the galaxies within that 2 square degrees, and the total number of galaxies which we detect is roughly of the order of 1 million galaxies. So it's an enormous sample of data with which to sample the bending of the space along the line of sight to the background galaxies.
Can you give us some background on how the survey came about?
The Cosmos Survey was initiated as a result of a workshop convened by the director of Space Telescope Science Institute, Steve Beckwith, about 3 years ago. And at that workshop, I was in charge of suggesting ideas for large-scale cosmological surveys of galaxy evolution. And so I came up with this idea to map a very extended area, which would be fairly deep, but not as deep as the ultra-deep field where the GOODS surveys, but cover a much larger area of the sky. And there was a lot of enthusiasm at that workshop, so we put together a proposal for the HST cycles 12 and 13 to actually image this full 2 square degrees in 2 different filters on the ACS camera, one filter being the I-band or 8,000 angstrom filter, and the other being a so-called G or green band at 4,700 angstroms. And the TAC, realizing that this was a very important project, they gave us time to do one of those filters, which was the 600 orbits, which I mentioned earlier. We're still trying to get the green band imaging, and we will probably propose for that in the future. The result of getting this enormous allocation, which turned out to be 10% of the time on the Hubble telescope for those 2 years, is the largest allocation ever made on the telescope. We have gotten time on essentially every other major telescope. Very importantly, the Subaru telescope, the 8-meter Japanese telescope in Hawaii, was used for ground-based imaging in multiple color filters to obtain the colors of all the million galaxies within the field. And then using those colors, we can derive the redshifts of the galaxies. Because obviously, if you take a galaxy like the Milky Way and redshift it to redshift 1, the whole spectrum is shifted towards the red end of the spectrum, and its colors, as observed in the visible, will actually change. So you can use this to determine what is called a photometric redshift for the galaxy, and hence infer the distance to each individual galaxy in the entire survey area.
Nick, beyond applying for time for green band imaging, what's next for this project?
Another major increase to the project will be after the next servicing mission for Hubble. The next servicing mission will install a new camera called WIFPIC 3, which actually has a near-infrared channel at 1.6 microns, which will be vital for mapping the galaxies across this field, and in particular for extending the Cosmos survey to higher redshift, because of course at higher redshift the galaxies, their visible light is shifted into the infrared, so you need infrared imaging.
Nick, why would our universe cease to exist without dark matter?
In the numerical simulations done for the production of structure in our universe, that is, the universe, of course, starts out as a very hot, fairly uniform gas as a result of the Big Bang explosion. As it expands, it cools, it becomes easier to condense structures or condensations within that gas. But in order to see the degree of structure that we actually see, it requires a large component of mass, which is not visible, it's not seen in the galaxies, but it helps the galaxies to actually condense and form.
There's not enough regular or baryonic matter to gravitationally collapse into the structures we see today. If it wasn't for the dark matter, our simulations show that the universe would be much smoother, and we wouldn't get the stars and galaxies that we see today.
The other thing is that it has to be what is called cold dark matter, because if it was hot dark matter, it would have trouble producing very tight structures. The internal kinetic energy would be too much to produce small structures.
Jason, one remarkable thing about weak lensing is it's a fairly young technique, yet it's become an essential tool for a cosmologist.
Weak lensing was only first detected in large-scale structures like this in the year 2000, and that was just, like I said, a detection. We could see the signal, but we couldn't really measure anything very well. So in the past 6 years, we've continued to improve the techniques of weak lensing, and more importantly, we've gotten better and better surveys, and by better and better I mean better image quality and larger surveys, and at least for space-based weak lensing, that's culminated in this Cosmos survey, which is probably the largest area survey we can hope to get with HST, because, as Nick said, it was 10% of HST time over 2 years, and future additions to the Cosmos survey will probably be imaging the same area at different wavelengths. So this technique has, this weak lensing technique, has really come into its own in the past 5 or 6 years. It's, like I said, it started out as something that was theorized, then detected, and now it's one of the premier tools of cosmology, and especially precision cosmology, where we're able to understand different cosmological parameters, such as the amount of dark matter, the distribution of dark matter, and the dark matter power spectrum, as we call it. We can use weak lensing to measure those things, finally, and it's becoming a tool on par with, say, the cosmic microwave background or supernova. For the future, this bodes really well for weak lensing, because one of the most mysterious aspects of the universe now is this dark energy, which is sort of an anti-gravity that's causing the universe's expansion to accelerate. Weak lensing, it turns out, is an excellent tool also for measuring the dark energy, and this study we've done with the Cosmos survey validates the techniques that we'll use in the future to use weak lensing as a study of the dark energy. These dark matter structures that we see, the growth of those dark matter structures over time, or the growth as we move closer to us in redshift, that growth is determined almost entirely by the dark energy, especially at more recent times, because dark energy is now the most dominant component of the universe, more dominant than the dark matter, or especially the baryonic matter, which makes up only a few percent of the universe. So the dark energy determines the growth of these structures. So if we can measure the growth of these dark matter structures via weak lensing, then we can determine the properties of the dark energy that is governing the growth of those structures.
Thank you, Nick and Jason. If you'd like to learn more about the Cosmos Project, you can find a link to their website on this show's page, which you can find at astronomy.com/podcast. Next week, Michael Bakich will return to take you on another tour of a constellation.
Until then, thanks for listening.